Hello and welcome to the Olin Finance Club CareerCast. In this podcast, we take a look at the potential careers opened up by pursuing your finance education. I'm your host, James Dutton, and today we'll be talking with Dan Connor of Ascend Venture Capital. If you enjoy the podcast or are interested in learning more about finance, consider joining the Olin Finance Club on WUGO, LinkedIn, or WeChat. All right, hello and welcome everybody. Thank you for being here. I'm here with my guest, Dan Connor. And Dan, would you please give us a little bit about your background and just a bit about yourself?
Hey, sure. Yeah, happy to. And thanks for inviting me to record with you here. So in a previous life, I was an engineer. I was a performance engineer, mostly offshore and mostly international, off the coast of Brazil and Argentina to begin with, and then off the coast of the UK, and all in the energy sector, clean energy and oil and gas. And then I came to St. Louis to do grad school, and I did some more energy engineering grad work and business school. And in the chrysalis of my finance classes, I emerged a finance guy. And from there, I had set my sights on venture capital and started a couple of businesses with very limited successes to begin with. And ended up starting a fund in 2015 that ended up performing quite well and allowing me to essentially go pro in 2018, and we've been off to the races ever since. Both funds are performing at 30% plus IRR with like a 4.7 times return on invested capital. So we're really happy with that performance, and it's still ascending. We have a couple of companies that are about to just go wild. So that's really great. And based on that momentum, we were able to hit the street to raise fund three in late last year. And we'll be fundraising for the rest of this year to close the fund. So we're excited to be off to the races of fund three as well.
Dan, that's awesome to hear. And we're going to talk a lot about your fund, but could you take a minute to maybe discuss what you learned by starting some companies and going through the buildup and the failure process a little bit, and just kind of how that helps you out in your career?
Yeah, for sure. There's so much to be learned. I mean, the first thing that's noticeable is the pace of activity. You wear so many hats in the early stages of a company. The finance person will be doing things in the HR column. The CEO will be out selling, fundraising, and gathering up the threads of all the operational processes. The sales team or the analysts will end up doing finance roles, and so they that pace is really great, and the ability to deliver somebody all the information that they need to complete a task is it happens multiple times in an hour, and that pace is really noticeable and something that I'm actually quite attached to now. So that's one thing. The other is this capacity for legwork. You got to learn how to hustle in a startup, and whether it comes to fundraising or sales, just going through long lists of contacts and emailing each one and following each one through to its conclusion. From everything from follow-up to closing, those lessons learned are probably the two biggest. The third aspect is, role-specific things that you're not born knowing, but they're not rocket science either. How to set up your QuickBooks or how to do bookkeeping on an ongoing basis so that you don't have a hornet's nest when you finally get time to look at it, or everything from a business expense policy to a travel policy. Those things are, after you've learned them once, it takes a very short amount of time to transfer them to the new shop.
Yeah, and would you make the argument maybe that it's useful to start out at a maybe an early stage company or starting your own company to learn all those rules? Or do you think it's more of just about how you want to progress in your career? Because that does sound like you had a lot of great experiences very quickly that are transferable to anything that you'd have wanted to do.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult it's a difficult way to go because the startup world is very risky. So you have to be careful about choosing the startup that you're going to work for with the same level of scrutiny that you would as a venture capital company select a company to invest in. And so if you can get that aspect right, then you're kind of on your way already to knowing what you need to know to work at a venture capital firm. But going assuming that you can pick a winner to begin with to go and work for, that's an extremely valuable set of working knowledge that you can then tap into in moving forward. There are other ways to be successful in the industry. I think maybe one of the best ways to go about it would be to start your own venture capital company. That would, as a startup yourself, give you the education in some of the business processes that you would need to know at least to help portfolio companies along in those same stages.
And you're bringing up starting up your own venture firm, which is obviously what you did. So can you talk maybe that you're talking about in 2015, you started the fund, but you said you weren't necessarily professional just yet. So could you maybe elaborate a little bit on what the early years looked like and maybe why you didn't feel like you were quite at the pro leagues just yet?
Yeah. So there are a number of ways to start a venture capital firm. One of the most common ways is to be on the founding team of a company that goes multiple billions in valuation and ends up IPOing and making everybody rich. You can hit the street to fundraise and perhaps raise $100 million for your first fund, and then go once you actually start that shop up, then you kind of have to figure out how to invest that money and put into motion all of the practices that need to happen to run a successful firm on day one. To me, the other path makes a little more sense conceptually. It's more of a scientific method of proving out a theme and a set of processes and a working knowledge and skill at actually investing. And that is to invest in a fund, one that is your own or a small measure of family money that you can essentially run as a side hustle and start to look through long lists of companies and picking winners for that side hustle fund and call that fund one. And it could be a fairly modest amount of money to begin with. But based on the track record of performance of that fund, you can then go on to raise a sizable fund two, like I did. And then put into practice the lessons learned, the processes, the knowledge base that you've built up in the side fund for a matter of years, and then go through another iteration of this sort of test, implement, improve, test cycle. So that process I think is invaluable when it comes time to raise, real funds from outside investors.
Okay. And you mentioned a theme, and I'm going to ask about that here pretty shortly, but could you maybe walk through at least what the learning process was like to actually setting up the fund, the legal work, et cetera? Because, I mean, you didn't say legal background, right? Engineering and finance. So was there any, I guess, a steep learning curve to figure out, making sure you're taking the correct steps for it to legally being an invest to legally invest other people's money, to make sure you're correctly setting up the contracts, everything? Can you just walk through that a little bit?
Yeah. So the subscription documents are a set of long legal language that sets up protections for not only you and your investors. So that process has to be done well. So, in that realm, I would recommend working with or teaming up with a legal counsel that you can trust to set up your documents to be successful. But from subscription document set to subscription document set, they're fairly boilerplate or similar to each other. when you really dive in. So that process and the structuring of the actual entities, again, it's not one of those things that you're born knowing how to do, but it's not impossible to figure it out. And there's kind of a practiced way of doing things that it just is laid out before you if you can work with the right legal counsel.
Got it. And now what I think might be your favorite part, let's talk about the theme and the thesis of your fund here. So could you just try to give us just an understanding of exactly how you think about investing in venture?
Yeah. So I guess preceding the theme is coming up with the right thesis, right? So to me, gone are the days of being able to raise $100 million and try and set up a generalist fund in which you invest in all latitudes and all sectors indiscriminately, because essentially you're going up to compete directly against, you know, the venture capital firms that have hundreds of millions of dollars under management and have the capacity to do hundreds, if not thousands, of deals to create what is essentially an index of the venture capital world at that stage. And that's not a great investment thesis to go up against directly in competition with those firms. So instead, right now, I think a much better way to get started in the world of venture capital is to reflect on the major persistent forces that are happening in the world, and try and figure out the sort of central thesis behind all of those forces, and then start to invest in companies that are playing a role in either the transition of the world in that particular way, or will play a role in the future state of that world. So how we implemented that in our theme is we saw that there's this dramatic evolution underway in which the world is being transformed by this new expectation that every decision should be made based on data. We see that in our daily lives multiple times a day, from, you know, everything in our lives as a consumer to every level of an organization that we work at, from HR to new product innovation, and even, you know, in our schools, in our administration, in our favorite charities, that everyone is starting to expect that all decisions should be backed by data. And that expectation has massive implications on entire industries. Massive industries right now are realizing that that every company that needs to stay competitive in that industry needs to be data-centric, needs to become a data company, essentially. And in paradigm shift like that, there's a real opportunity for venture capital investors to make a bet in a company that, as I described before, will power the future state of an industry that is undergoing that paradigm shift. So that's what we're looking for. That's the thesis of our fund. We are looking for the companies that will sit in the center of an industry to power its future state as it goes data-centric. So kind of like the, you know, a predicate example is Microsoft in the software paradigm shift in the early aughts. Every company needed to be a software company overnight. It didn't matter if you were a blue chip company or a startup. You had to do business with Microsoft, and Microsoft was a startup at that time. So so investors in Microsoft at that point were able to grow faster than the industry was growing itself, which is the exact goal for venture capital returns. So we've adopted that as our theme for at least this family of funds. And that's been playing out quite well in our favor.
Okay. And I'm wondering, so, you know, kind of the bigger taglines that you put, at least on your website, are the idea of first movers, network effects, persistent trends, et cetera. I mean, what exactly does that mean to you? You know, is there anything else that you'd like to kind of add into that, or do you feel like it's a little bit more self-explanatory there.
Yeah, yeah. So the criteria that we use to select companies, or at least early on in the diligence process to move them forward, is quite simple. So first off, we are a micro VC still, so we can't afford to enter into arenas in which there are multiple well-funded competitors, because we can't successfully source the hundreds of millions of dollars of checks that are required for a company to be successful against that competitive balance in those arenas. So that's what's behind this first mover criteria, is that we need to be selective about companies that are unique in their approach to solving a problem. And so so that's something that we put into practice very very actively. Another one is the problem that they are solving has to be mission critical to the companies that they're working with. So for the customer base, does that problem rank among the top three at least strategic priorities for their company, for them to remain competitive in their industry? If it doesn't, then we can't move forward with that deal, because the what you're signing up for, if it's an incremental improvement to a problem that's not mission critical, is longer sales cycles, poorer unit economics, a longer time to raise additional funding. It just is a strategically dominated way of moving forward. So number one, we're looking for first movers that are unique in their approach to solve a massive problem. That problem has to be mission critical. And number three is, it kind of goes back to that thesis that I described before. There have to be persistent, inevitable trends that are pushing the industry to a certain undeniable destination, an undeniable conclusion. And we could talk more about that later.
Yeah, well, we know what you're looking for now. So maybe can you just talk about how you find it? Everyone wanted to invest in Microsoft 20 years later, but how did the first people find the Microsoft? And how are you? Or, what's your thought process behind finding that truly revolutionary company?
Yeah. So our whole operation, our whole practice of investing, making investment decisions, is wrapped around. It drives our whole strategy in our company. We recognize that if you can just do one thing well in the venture capital world, at least from the beginning. Essentially from the beginning, then everything else is paved for you in the future. If you can just pick winners, if you can just make that investment decision well, then everything else falls into place. And you'd be surprised how few firms actually recognize that and get that incorporated into their strategic operations. So one of the ways that we make sure that we're capable of not only finding those unique opportunities and be able to recognize them when we do find them, is by what we've learned to call encyclopedic deal flow. So we cover more ground than anybody in the industry. We cover 500 deals a month, which we just crossed the 15,000 companies reviewed mark. And what that means is that as you look through those long lists, you start to get an inherent sense for what's a common concept of company that's out trying to solve the same problem. We would not be able to recognize a unique company without knowing with certainty that there are numerous companies trying to solve that same problem. And you could try and do Google searches to figure out if that's true in certain cases, but the problem is that a lot of these companies aren't yet available in search queries or anything. So it would be very difficult to figure out what competitors are out there for certain areas. And in a lot of cases, a lot of those companies are operating in stealth before you can even figure out what they do. So it's very tricky to at the point in time of, you know, initial review, trying to figure out if one company has a number of competitors, unless you've gone through a long practice of figuring out, you know, what's a commonly attacked theme in the industry. So that's how we go about finding these opportunities.
And that's a pretty massive deal flow. So I'm just wondering here, how big is your team and how much are you leveraging technology to be able to sift through that many companies in a month?
Yeah, so we have a team of five. So we have, so I'm the general partner. We're bringing on another partner before the end of the year. We have an associate and two advisors. That number that we're achieving every month of companies reviewed has to be hit by everyone on the investment team. So we leverage a lot of different tools to fill that funnel. We have to, as you can imagine, we can't trust that 500 deals will simply be sent to us by our trusted sources. So we have to actively go out and look for the bulk of that number every month. And we do that by subscribing to databases like PitchBook, Crunchbase, Mattermark, AngelList, CB Insights. With the breadth of all of those databases, we can confidently say that we're getting a read on a cross-section of the entire stage of deals that we're looking for.
Okay, so you've found your company, and you've sifted through all these companies. You found one that you want to pursue. How do you start building that relationship with the management team to actually get to the point where you could make an investment?
Yeah, that's the easy part. Actually, at the early stage, pre-seed and seed, everyone will take your call. It's an unbelievable dynamic. It's very different at the later stages. Think about it this way. If you had tried to email the CEO of Rent the Runway before they IPO'd, there's no chance that they would get a response, that you would get a response. But if you had caught them in the pre-seed stage when it was a handful of people operating a scrappy operation, then they would return your email because they're not getting looks by that many potential funders. So how we do things is just reach out to every company that we're actually pursuing seriously. If our research backs up the idea that this company could be promising, then only then do we reach out, because we want to make sure that conversation is still worthwhile to those founders, because despite the fact that they might be taking all conversations, their time is still valuable. So from that aspect, finding somebody's email address, finding them on LinkedIn, making a connection point, and then starting the conversation is the easy part of how we do things.
And how does that look maybe 1 year, 2 years after investment? How often are these founders coming back to you? Obviously, with being micro VC, you're not cutting them huge, huge checks. So are they still kind of continuously reaching out, asking for support, or is it more like, all right, thank you for the money, we'll get back to you in 3 years with your returns? How's that look?
At the early stages of a startup life cycle, you need all the help you can get. So we are very active from the moment that we invest throughout the life cycle of the company. For example, a company of ours is raising a Series B right now. We invested in them in 2019, and we email with them nearly every day, trying to help them make new customer introductions. And because they're raising their Series B, engaging with other investors in our network to see if they'd like to get in touch to potentially participate in that fundraise. So we're very active, and the way that we run our operations to be able to be that active is by keeping the number of portfolio companies small for each fund. So kind of the back of the envelope calculation that everybody runs their firm by in the industry is that you make 30 investments, hopefully you find one unicorn in the bunch. The majority of them return 1 to 2x capital, and the rest are blow up on the launch pad. So our being able to assume that we can make investment decisions well allows us to target a much smaller number of portfolio companies, assuming that each one has the potential to be a unicorn, and then invest a lot of time in each and every one of them to help them along as much as we can to that outcome. So we are only looking for 10 companies in each fund, and that allows us again to spend time with each one, and really put a lot of stock in that idea that they are, you know, they're on their way to unicorn status.
Got it. And what's the typical size of deal that your fund is right or kind of check size there? And then what would be the form of deal you prefer, of safe convertible note, just straight equity? What are you guys usually looking for?
Yeah. So, our initial check size is between 50 and 150K. When the fundraise is over for fund three, we may be upping that a little bit, but it wouldn't be a crazy increase in that initial check size. And then what we reserve for follow-on capital is a ratio of 4 to 1 on the initial investment size. So the bulk of our funds are geared to get aggressive in the Series Seed and Series A timeframe. So we'll make an initial investment in the pre-seed or seed, and then get aggressive soon after that with the rest of our capital. And you know, that takes all kinds of different forms, equity or convertible note. My lawyer would prefer that I not do safes, but we have ventured in that column before.
Got it. And then these last two questions I have for you might kind of flow together, so I'll ask them both kind of like last one there. But do you see any trends that are affecting the way you're getting deals? And then also part of that, are deals becoming easier as you're better understanding how to leverage your team, or are you finding it more difficult as other firms are moving, kind of like the split in VC of moving either later stage or early stage and staying not necessarily away from A, but you know, the shift within the industry. So are you seeing maybe more people competing for your deals?
What you're describing is scope creep. So funds increasingly look earlier and earlier with larger pools of capital behind them. How that works out is that a decade ago, a Series A deal did not look like what a Series A deal is commonly looked at right now. So what a Series A deal commonly resembles right now. So regardless of that, no, we haven't found that it's become more difficult or more easy to find quality deals. We are still able to be very selective about the companies that we're looking for, and you know, at this stage, it's very collaborative. You know, any other investors who are looking at the same deal are eager to get other active shops on their cap table.
All right, then last real tough question for you here. What keeps you excited about venture capital? What makes you wake up every day happy to you know, be working for your own fund and just, you know, getting after it?
Yeah, so there are a couple things. So number one, it's different every day, right? I come into the office one day and have to do a deep dive into. So yesterday I was going deep on 5G, software defined networks and virtual network functions and that rabbit hole for a company that we're reviewing. And then today I've got to go deep on HR tech, in particular paid time off, and how a company is positioning themselves to engage with companies to make that aspect of employment a little more beneficial to employees. We're in the process of running diligence on a company that works with gig workers to help smooth out their income for their gig workers. So it's different every day, and that is that's very energizing to continue to try and expand our knowledge base of what's new and what's interesting in the world. Number two, the potential for surprises to jump into your inbox every morning is also very energizing. You never know when the point comes that someone in your founder list of portfolio companies emails you one day saying that, hey, we just raised a giant Series B, and it's, you know, that means that your investment position has you know, tripled in value, which is a significant increase for our IRRs. That potential for upside surprises is fantastic. It happens with some regularity. So we're very energized by those moments. But outside of that, I'm it's the best job in the world. The ability to talk to people who actually want to talk to you, engage with investors who trust you for finding interesting and promising companies, and backing companies that are powering the future state of an industry is a very rewarding business to be in.
Dan, thank you so much for your time today. As a little wrap up here, what's the best way to learn more about your firm, and what's any parting advice you might have for a student looking to get into VC?
Yeah, so we have a lot of activity on our blog and our press page. So that's probably the best place to start. We have a lot of information about how we do things and how we think about the world that we post with a regular basis. And then from there, you know, subscribing to our newsletter or our LinkedIn page follow us on Twitter is another way to learn more about us. The advice that I can offer to anybody who's trying to break into VC is that it's very challenging, and there are a few ways to break in. The number one way of doing it tends to be go to an Ivy League school, work at an investment bank for 2 years, get into Harvard Business School, and then get hired as a VP at a private equity or venture capital company, and that isn't obviously open to the majority of people who want to break into VC. So the second way of doing it is by starting a company or jumping on the founding team of a company that is destined to be successful. Again, putting into practice some of those that selection criteria that will be useful when you actually do break into the venture world. And number three, the other channel of potentially doing it is to do it yourself, to start to put into practice the concepts that you think could be successful in investing via a side fund or a hypothetical fund, and then start building a track record from there. And you know, if it does prove out to be successful, then start to prove it out further by raising a small fund to put into practice some of those concepts.
Dan, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you've made it this far, thank you for listening in. If you have any feedback, feel free to reach out to the Finance Club leadership on LinkedIn or via Woosel email. And stay up to date on podcasts or live events, join Owen Finance Club on WooGo, LinkedIn, or WeChat.